Hello everyone, this is Bob Zeta. My amateur radio call sign is N1BLF, November 1, Bravo Lima Foxtrot. We'll be reading together today, here on the Courage Handy Ham System, World Radio Magazine, the online edition. World Radio is a publication of CQ Communications, Incorporated, 25 Newbridge Road, Hicksville, New York, 11801. This recording is a production of the Courage Hand Ham System, 3915 Golden Valley Road, Golden Valley, Minnesota, 55422. It is for the use of eligible Handy Ham members only. Any other use may violate copyright laws. Handy Hams may be reached at area 763-520-0512 or at email address handyham@courage.org. The website www.handyham.org. Let's begin today in World Radio Online Newsfront. CQ columnist Dave Graham, K4TWJ, Silent Key. It is with great sadness that we report that our friend and longtime colleague Dave Ingram, K4TWJ, became a Silent Key. He passed away January 20th as a result of complications from a massive heart attack he suffered on New Year's Eve 2009. Dave has been writing for CQ at least since 1981 and has been a CQ columnist since 1982, starting with an amateur television column called World of Video. This column eventually broadened into Outlook and became World of Ideas, Dave's signature monthly column in CQ magazine. Regular topics included code keys, stealth antennas, building new vintage tube gear, and mobiling. In addition, for the past decade, Dave has been CQ's QRP, low power commentator, and how it works columnist. His enthusiasm for whatever caught his interest was contagious and spread widely through his informational yet educational writing style. Condolence cards may be sent to Dave's wife, Sandy. Her call is WB4OEE at their call book address. Sandy has also asked that a contribution in Dave's memory be made to the American Heart Association. Nebraska may keep ham weather spotters emergency lights. Several of Nebraska's emergency coordinators and others involved in crisis management raised concern last year about a new law prohibiting distinctive lighting on the vehicles of storm and severe weather spotters. Many weather spotters felt that these lights protected them while parked in isolated areas where occasional high-speed traffic presented a danger. Thanks to James R. Reeder, K0JWR, a bill was introduced on January 6th by District 28 Senator Bill Avery to amend the law on vehicle lighting to allow use of distinctive amber lights by storm spotters. In part, the measure states that rotating or flashing amber lights can be displayed by any motor vehicle being operated by or on behalf of a weather reporter spotter. The spotter must hold an unrevoked and unexpired amateur radio station license issued by the Federal Communications Commission. It also applies to emergency management workers while they are engaged in responding to an emergency. The measure has been designated as Nebraska LB-719. That's the number of the bill. Nebraska hams are being asked to take a moment and send an email or letter to their representative state legislators in support of the bill. This information was filed by K0AIZ. Sweden withdraws some BPL-PLT modems from the market. Score won in the BPL at broadband over power line war for ham radio. The January 5 issue of the Eurocom newsletter has a welcome item on the withdrawal by Sweden of polluting power line adapters. The edition notes that Sweden has withdrawn some broadband over power line or PLT modems of the nation's market. The Swedish administration argued that those devices did not meet the threat protection provided by the harmonized standard. It also noted that in many cases, harmful interference could actually be measured. It said that in those cases, reception in accordance with ITU regulations was no longer possible, and therefore the essential requirements violated. That was filed by Southgate. Let's go down under now to Australia. Australian radar leaves 10 megahertz ham ban. The IARU R1 website reports that an ionosphere radar in Australia has left the amateur radio spectrum in the 10 megahertz band. The report says that following complaints filed by Victor Kilo 4 Delta Uniform and DJ9DKR to the La Trobe University, that the Tiger radar in Brony, Tasmania, agreed to change the frequency databases. Also, guarantees were made that in the future, no ham radio band will be interfered by this ionospheric radar system. That was submitted by IARU Region 1. Hopscotching the world again, India's StudSat to launch in the month of March. Listen, India's, apparently an organization, StudSat, one word, or student satellite, is slated for a March 2010 launch and will carry a camera capable of 90-meter resolution. StudSat is described as a small cube weighing about 850 grams. The satellite is intended to be launched in 700-kilometer sun-synchronous orbit and will perform the function of a remote sensing satellite and take images of Earth's surface with a resolution of 90 meters, the best achieved by the PICO category satellite in the world. It will likely carry a 10-milliwatt UHF slant CW beacon and also a half-duplex FSK link with 1-watt output, also on UHF, that's ultra-high frequency. The work on this particular satellite, StudSat, started in the year 2007. That was filed by ANS. Let's pop in one more Newsfront commentary. Ham Radio and the Bravo 2 Victor B2V Challenge Cup Relay. Hams are needed to assist in providing communications for the Santa Clarita, California contingent taking part in the upcoming Baker to Vegas Challenge Cup Relay. The race takes place April 16th to the 18th. The course begins about 12 miles west of Baker, California, on Highway 127, heads to the fabled city of Pahrump, Nevada, turns onto the Blue Diamond Highway towards Las Vegas. There are 250 teams each with 26 runners, three support vehicles with at least two support people in each vehicle, divided by two shifts each, supported by 12 volunteer ham radio operators. There are 20 stages to this event, and they do run through the night, hot, cold, high winds, and rain. If this event interests you and you would like to volunteer, please contact the amateur call KI6CCW at ARRL.net. That's actually an email address. It is an amateur radio call, KI6CCW at ARRL.net. More about the Baker to Vegas Challenge Cup Relay is online at www.bakervegas.com. That was submitted by KI6CCW. Let's go now to the editor's log. The editor is Nancy Cott, Whiskey Zulu 8, Charlie, WC8C. Many World Radio Online readers know by now that I have resigned as editor. I've been dragging my feet about writing this last ed log, thinking it meant saying goodbye. However, upon reflection, I realized that over the dozen or so years I have been associated with World Radio and World Radio Online, I have come to think of the readers as my friends. In the earlier years, when writing a CW column, CW, folks, is actually Morse code, I wrote it as if I were sharing my thoughts with friends. Considering people whom you have never met to be friends is something that is unique to hams. Sure, now there are chat rooms, but do you really know if the person you are chatting with is whom they say they are? With ham radio, if they know Morse code or can talk about antennas, you can be pretty sure they're the real thing. As years went on, although we didn't always agree, it was always interesting and inspiring to read your letters and comments on the internet. I wouldn't trade those days as CW columnist for anything. My readers were very special to me, and I still keep in touch with many of them. After I became the editor, it was even more fun because I was able to talk about more topics than Morse code and stir up some controversy. There were times when some of the posts on the internet and emails would be so hot that I discovered firsthand why they called it flames. I don't think anyone changed anyone's mind, but it opened up dialogue and gave readers a place to vent and know that someone was listening. Once hams become friends, their relationship can stand the test of time. Whether you see someone once a year in Dayton or run into them on the air 5 years after an especially interesting QSO, it's like no time has passed and you pick up where you left off. I'm not going to say goodbye because you'll be seeing me around. I'll be at various hamfests or on a de-expedition. We're planning one for September. The expedition, folks, is actually going to a foreign location. And, of course, on the air. I have more time now. Thank you for your encouragement and support. It helped me to have the courage of my convictions and do the right thing even when it wasn't always the easiest choice. Many of you are FISTS members, F-I-S-T-S. That's an organization about Morse code. So we'll connect through the FISTS keynote newsletter. If you're not a FISTS member, drop me a note occasionally at nancy@tir.com or my P.O. Box 47, Hadley, Michigan, MI, 48440. If you're interested in what I'm up to but don't want to write, check out my web page at www.home.tir.com/thewigglenancy or friend me on the Facebook. Boy, that thing gets everywhere, doesn't it, folks, huh? I'd like to wrap it up by thanking Rich Moss and W2VU for his infinite patience, expertise, and tact, and Dottie and Liz in the production department for helping me get the hang of what it takes to get a magazine online. How everyone on the staff is able to juggle getting 4 magazines to completion is an amazing feat. Therefore, I leave you, my friends, in the capable hands of Richard Fisher, KI6SN. Richard is a good guy and my first choice for the next editor. I'm sure he'll do a terrific job. See you on the air. And in the words of Gene Shepard, K2ORS, now a silent key, keep a clean fist. 73-88-33, Nancy Cott, WZ8C. Let's take a look at our first featured article. It's titled, Two Seasoned Hams Help a Friend in Need. The author here is John E. Gherkin. His call is Alpha Alpha 9, Uniform Foxtrot, AA9UF. My close friend of 36 years, Brett Hassman, amateur radio call KB8BJA, is disabled due to a severe heart attack, type 2 diabetes, and kidney failure. He goes for dialysis 3 days a week. His physical abilities are severely limited by his illnesses to the point that he could no longer work. Being disabled at the age of 50 is frustrating, and certainly not the way he wanted to live, but he had to make the best of a bad situation. He lives with his 77-year-old father in a double-wide mobile home in Cincinnati, Ohio. Brett has not been active in ham radio for about 15 years and wanted to get back into it. His father has problems maintaining his balance, and with Brett's disability, any ladder work was out of the question, so they didn't dare to try to put up an antenna. Brett bought a Gap Challenger DX Vertical, that's a straight up and down antenna, and I sold Brett an Alpha Delta DXCC dipole and 53 feet of coax and told him that I would come to his house and put up his antennas. He was flabbergasted that I would do such a thing, but he had been my friend for 35 years, and that's what friends do. I thought it would be good to have my brother Glenn, N0PNQ, come along with me since he is pretty handy with tools and such. He lives in St. Charles, Missouri. I asked him if he would be up for that, and he jumped at the opportunity. I wanted to see if I could find a used computer CPU for Brett's ham shack. My wife said she had one at the school where she teaches that nobody used anymore, so she brought it home. I checked it out, and it was toast. The dust on the processor was thick enough to plant a row of potatoes. It wouldn't even boot up. It was now time for Plan B. I called Glenn again, and he said he would see if EPC Computers had anything. That's apparently a retailer. 3 days later, he called me to say that he found a really nice one with Windows XP already loaded. Pentium 4 processor, 512 RAM, CD-ROM, and the new keyboard with an optical mouse thrown in for $102. Not bad. Let's hope it works. I was indeed surprised and elated at this news. All Brett will need is an LCD flat-screen monitor, and those can be had for cheap. Glenn came to my house on Thursday evening, August 27th. I had pretty much everything packed in the van as I had worked at it through the week after work. I took along a wheelbarrow, shovel, spade, two post-hole diggers, a work-made portable workbench, numerous hand tools, a hammer drill, cordless drill, etc. Glenn and I left my house in Bellflower, Illinois on Friday, August 28th during pouring rain. It rained until we got pretty close to Crawfordsville, Indiana. At one point between Champaign and Covington, Indiana, it was raining so hard that visibility was becoming an issue with the trucks kicking up spray in front of us. We finally got into sunny conditions on the east side of Indy and on into Cincinnati. We arrived at a motel, got checked in, and stowed our luggage in the room. Then we went on to Brett's place, which was about 13 miles from the motel. As we pulled up to the house, Brett's father, George, came out to greet us. He was about to leave to pick Brett up from his dialysis session, so he invited us to have some iced tea and showed us where he wanted to plant a vertigo. The spot he chose would not work because of the close proximity to the metal siding and awnings of adjacent mobile homes. We persuaded him to put it in the front yard, where it would be in the clear. After a quick drink, we started unloading our tools to finish assembling the gap vertical, which was in the partially assembled sections on the front porch. After we got the antenna assembled, we broke for supper, visited for a bit, and then headed back to the motel for the night. We got up around 7 a.m. and went downstairs for breakfast and then headed over to the Home Depot store to buy concrete mix, eye bolts, and some rope, and then we headed on to Brett's house. It was going to be a big day. Glenn and I unloaded our tools for the concrete project. I was glad that I had brought all the implements that I did. We used everything I brought, even the 5-gallon bucket with the gravel for the bottom of the hole. In an hour, we had the hole dug to a depth of 38 inches and 12 inches across. We set the pipe in the hole and guided with some rope and 3 stakes. Then we mixed 2 80-pound bags of concrete and dumped it in. While the concrete was setting up, I dug a little trench from the vertical mass pipe to the house with a spade for the coax and installed electrical PVC at each end. At the vertical mass pipe, I installed a weather head on the end of 2 90-degree curves and about 3 feet of pipe. On the house end, I installed a piece of PVC with a 90-degree elbow, fastening it to the foundation with a 2-hole clamp and concrete anchors. Then Glenn and I worked on the getting of the coax up into the floor and terminated with the PL-259. Once that was done, we started work on the Alpha Delta DXCC dipole installation. When we were all done, we hooked up each antenna in turn and checked for flat tuning with Brett's radio, and both tuned down flat on all bands. Brett had a hard time keeping tears back at finally being able to get on the air. We let Brett do the honors of keying up to check the SWR, then Glenn got on his laptop and hooked up a single-link USB interface to show Brett what PSK31 is like. Brett made PSK contacts with me acting as control operator. His CQ message read that he was operating under supervision of Alpha Alpha 9 Uniform Foxtrot. He managed to contact with the station in Arizona. Brett knew I was looking for a computer for him, but he did not know that we actually found one or what was in it. His eyes got big, and he hardly knew what to say because he was so surprised at the deal Glenn had pulled off. It took us a good hour to get everything packed up into the van again. We thought we were tired enough this time to finally get some good rest, but we were up at 3:30 a.m. wide awake. I guess we were still pretty wired over the whole project. We decided that there was no sense in hanging around, so we checked out and were on the road home by 5:15 a.m. and back home by 9:20 a.m. We called Brett to let him know that we were home safely, and he said he had just made a contact on 40-meter CW. He said he was very rusty at copy, but he got enough of the message to call Lita Cuso. He said, "I'm back." That was indeed music to the Elmer's ears. Now we enjoy a skid on 40-meter CW on Saturday night at Zero's Time Zulu. The last time I spoke to him on the phone, he sounded much more upbeat and more like his old self. Few things in ham radio are more rewarding than being an Elmer. An Elmer is a term for a person that helps another person become familiar with amateur radio. I hope this inspires more seasoned hams to help a new ham or someone who needs assistance on the air. Well, folks, the article is concluded. The author was John E. Gerchen, AA4UF. Sometimes it's good to just listen to someone else's accounting of what they do on an average day in amateur radio. Folks, on pages 14 and 15 of the March 2010 World Radio Online is a list of FAR, F-A-R, scholarships, the Foundation for Amateur Radio Incorporated. It's a nonprofit organization with headquarters in Washington, D.C., and it's planning to administer 48 scholarships for the academic year 2010-2011 to assist licensed radio amateurs in the pursuit of higher education. The foundation fully funds two of these scholarships. The remainder are administered by the foundation without cost for various donors. Licensed radio amateurs may compete for these awards. They must be planning to pursue a full-time course of studies beyond high school and be enrolled or have been accepted for enrollment at an accredited university, college, or technical school. Clubs are encouraged, that is to say, amateur radio clubs are encouraged to announce these opportunities at their meetings, in their newsletters, during training classes, on their nets, and on their club's web pages. Applications are available for download from the Foundation's website. It goes as follows, http://www.fareweb.org/farweb.org. The Foundation for Amateur Radio Incorporated in the District of Columbia is an exempt organization under Section 501, Sub C, Sub 3 of the Internal Revenue Code of 1954. It is devoted exclusively to promoting the interests of amateur radio and those scientific, literary, and educational pursuits that advance the purposes of the amateur radio service. The cutoff date for applications is March 31st, 2010. This is a month earlier than in previous years, so you have to hurry on this if you are interested or know someone that is interested in applying for one of these Foundation for Amateur Radio Incorporated scholarships, the FAR scholarships. The 48 are listed on those two pages, pages 14 and 15 of World Radio Online for March 2010. And you should seek someone out to help you read them or look them up if you can't do it for yourself. Thrown in the mix here is a commentary for the Dayton Hamvention. It's sponsored by the Dayton Amateur Radio Association. The theme for the Dayton Hamvention this year is Amateur Radio Clubs Worldwide, the Lifeline. The dates, May 14 through 16, 2010, at Hara Arena in Dayton, Ohio. All the information you could possibly want is at www.hamvention.org. Well, as I look out the window, it's a very early in the morning. It's only 7:04 a.m. here in Dartmouth, Massachusetts. My ham shack for N1BLF, November 1 Bravo Lima Foxtrot. I see the sun coming up over the horizon. That tells me that the old man's sun or old gal's sun is creeping up faster every day. And that's about the time for more ham fests and special events. I have five of them listed here for those of you who like to listen in, if you will, or if you're driving around the country, drop by. It's like a flea market in amateur radio terms. They call them ham fests. First one listed is Indiana, 27th Annual Columbus, Indiana Amateur Radio Club Handfest. It's Saturday, March 27 at the Bartholomew County 4-H Fairgrounds, 750 West County Road. It's in the community building. The great state of Iowa, SWIARC Hamfest. That's an acronym for something. It's a long one. SWIARC Hamfest. It's on Saturday, March 6, 8 a.m. at the McClellan Hall, 170 My Street, McClellan, Iowa. Up in New England, New Hampshire, Contoocook Valley Radio Club, 2010 Hamfest. That's March 21st. It's at the Henniker Community School, 51 Western Avenue, Henniker, New Hampshire. Tennessee, 2010 Middle Tennessee Amateur Radio Society Hamfest. It's on March the 20th, First Methodist Church Center, Tullahoma, Tennessee. And in our friendly neighborhood, known as Canada, Special Event Station Victor Echo 3, X-Ray Romeo, VE3XR, will be operating from Brampton, Ontario, Canada, on March 27, from the Peel and Mississauga ARC's Ham X Annual Ham Fest. So there you go. Pay attention as you're driving around. You might find yourself an interesting little hour or two to look at all that stuff we call junk that's been used up and not quite dead yet. Well, I see a nice article by Carol Perry. Carol's call is WB2MGP. It's in the category of hams with class. The title, A Tale of Two Schools. In the past 2 months, I've had the distinct pleasure of giving radio talks and demonstrations to two completely different types of schools, each with different demographics and unique goals. The first school was an elementary school in Staten Island, New York, PS 69. I did two demonstrations there. The first group was fourth graders who were eager to try their hand at my little code key devices. Code keys are code practice oscillators designed for use with my Introduction to Amateur Radio class, which I taught full-time to 6th, 7th, and 8th graders at Intermediate School 72 until my retirement 5 years ago. After a demonstration of 2-meter contacts, we spoke about different modes of communications available to ham radio operators. It's always been my experience that youngsters absolutely love the Morse code part of my demos. These fourth graders were really excited about learning the letters of their names in code. They especially liked it when I assured them that their parents and teachers, as well as their other classmates, probably did not know about this special code that they were learning. The exclusive aspect counted for a lot. I had to promise to come back again in order to get the code keys back from their reluctant hands. Next in my bag of surprises was the unveiling of a 5-foot-tall poster of a fully suited astronaut with all the parts labeled. The students were so excited to hear about the astronaut's land space shuttle contacts that my classes had made during the years. We spoke about space travel and communications, zero gravity, and the fun of speaking with the astronauts while they were in orbit. My next presentation was to a group comprised of fifth graders. These students really surprised the science coordinator, Miss Sorrentino, and me with their intuitive remarks and questions about space travel and the use of the radio. I actually left out part of my prepared demo so that I could spend time answering the questions that interested them. I showed them a DVD of the astronauts having fun on board the space shuttle, playing with toys and performing tasks in zero gravity. When the bell rang, signaling the end of the period, there was a collective groan of disappointment. This, of course, was very gratifying to me as a teacher. I promise to come back again in a few more months to do the next level of demos to the same groups. With this level of interest and excitement, I regret there is no longer a ham radio program at the school I taught in, right across the street, to pick up all these eager students in the sixth grade. One of my goals is to get teachers in the schools I visit interested in getting their FCC licenses. Several weeks later, I participated in a career event at Neptune High School in Neptune Township, New Jersey. Drew Reynolds from Reynolds Recruiters, along with guidance counselor Sue Harms, sponsored the morning of introducing different specialists to the kids to get them excited about and to consider engineering in the future. Also sponsoring the event was the Women in Engineering Group, which is part of the IEEE New Jersey Coast section. At this school, the goal was to introduce interested high school seniors to different kinds of engineering possibilities, including careers in radio and communications. I had done a presentation at this particular high school before. Many of the seniors, along with the principal, had expressed a desire to have a ham radio station set up at the school. We are working together to make sure that it becomes a reality this year. I introduce my group to the basic electronics and technology involved with amateur radio. I give them charts of the different class frequency privileges, along with a chart of some popular ham radio websites to get more information. I told them about various career choices that were made by some of my former students. Many of my former students have contacted me years later to tell me of the influence that being in the ham radio program had on them. Students in the ham radio program get exposed to a great variety of topics and situations that the average student in a classroom usually doesn't. They learn about a myriad of career and job opportunities that they might otherwise never hear about. I was able to speak with a group about the relationship between the space program and amateur radio and provided them with lots of fact sheets and diagrams of the role of the radio in contacting the space shuttles and the International Space Station. We even had time to introduce Morse code on my code practice oscillators and sent out a group SOS message. What fun! Programs like this one at Neptune High School allow the students to encounter people in different professions and to broaden their choices about future education and career opportunities. These were two different schools with totally different agendas. They had one thing in common, though, the goal of exposing youngsters to a positive, fun, and interesting experience, in this case, through ham radio. So let's continue with the YLs, young ladies, in amateur radio. Are you keeping your resolutions? The author here is Cheryl Muir. Call us in 0WBV. Now that that new year is underway, how go the radio resolutions? Have you contacted the last one needed for a certain certificate? Did you upgrade after telling yourself someday? Have you sent out all your QSL cards so you can get some back? Hopefully the resolutions are working and you are where you want to be. And Manup, WB1ARU, is one of those who took the challenge to upgrade to extra. She has been licensed quite a while and decided it was time to move things along. Congratulations, Hannah. Now regarding the ladies in the pink, Betty Jo Berg, K5CSQ, writes, I have been on HF working on the YLRL continents, the YLRL-WAS, that's worked all states, and also the YLRL-DXCC awards. DXCC are international awards for companies out of the United States. Nope, it's not so easy, but it is a lot of fun hunting for YLs on the air. We need more of you on the air. My old man, that's her husband, and I purchased an Icon 7600 at Dayton Hamfest. We also attended Huntsville Hamfest with our friend George Bethia, K5JZ, where I purchased a pink heel microphone. Pink for breast cancer awareness. The Southern Mississippi YLs participated in the CQ Worldwide contest from my station using the club called WP5MZ. George's call is W5JZ. He set up the spectrum scope trace to the color pink, and with the pink heel mic, we were ready. Since then, another friend, Chris, K5MOZ, dropped off pink computer interface cables. K5JZ gave me a pink Daiwa SWR meter for Christmas. You can say the color pink has taken over our ham shack, which has the old man concerned. He won't talk on the pink microphone. Thanks for the update, Betty Jo. I hope she will send photographs so we can see it in full color. And don't worry, Betty Jo. It might not be the pink color on the mic. My old man John never even owned the microphone before I got on and started stirring things up with the female voice. Hi, hi. And Carol Muir, the author, gives us a reminder not to forget the YL Nets on the radio throughout the world. There's a host of YL Nets, but the band conditions may have made them hard to recognize. The YLs are still getting on both 40 and 20 meters in the general voice portions of the amateur bands on Thursday nights at 100 UTC, that's Universal Time Constant, or Zulu Time, or 2 o'clock, depending on daylight savings time. Check out www.ylrl.org for more nets around the world. The Canadian ladies are still listening for you on Monday nights with the Clara net as well. Hopefully the band conditions will come back so we can actually hear each other again. Now on the subject of weather and antennas, Jacqueline Goslin, N3ZEL, brings up a great point for many of us living with changing seasons. She says, "This is a weather that wreaks havoc on antennas. My old man has been checking on the dipole, making sure it is still up there and not tangled in the branches of the pine trees. So far, so good. And we're hoping it hangs on until warmer weather to have maintenance done. Of course, the rule of thumb is that antenna work will be required on the coldest, iciest possible day, usually in February. Let's hope that none of us will be victims of that form of Murphy's Law." Jackie was so right. In Colorado, we get extreme seasons, and almost every year we have to take down the verticals and dipoles to fix them. The metal wears, and don't even get me started on the thin air and what it does to coax cables. Here's hoping you all got new antennas for the holidays, and that they stay solid at least until summer. You know, folks, just as an aside, this is Bob, your reader. As you know, my amateur call is N1BLF. My location, or QDH, is in Dartmouth, Massachusetts, right down here by New Bedford and Buzzards Bay. Well, as it so happens, I experienced a little bit of an antenna failure as well. I have a very, very large antenna up on a 70-foot tower, and mother weather, or old man winter, whichever you want to say it, took down my 36-foot reflector. So that's the way it goes. I'll have to see what happens without it on there. Hi, hi. Well, continue with Cheryl commentary. There is a silent key to announce. Dorothy, Peggy, Stone, KB7SBK, became a silent key on November 3, 2009. Ty Kearney, W7WPF, slant SK, interested Peggy in ham radio. She soon got her license, upgrading to general class. She became very active in amateur radio and worked many stations, including DX. She often checked in to the YLNet. Now, with regard to future activities, what are your radio plans for the summer? We have contests, awards, certificates to chase, the Dayton Hamvention, Field Day, and many possible expeditions to hunt down or be a part of, plus the Wild International meet in Germany this year. Let me know what you are up to, and also, as always, I hope to see you on the bands. That was submitted by Cheryl Muir, M-U-H-R, call November 0, Whiskey Bravo Victor. Next up here is the Quarter Century Wireless Association, the QCWA. The article is submitted by Dave Hayes, Victor Echo 3, Juliet X-ray, VE3JX. The piece is titled QCWA's MIP, Most Important Position. This article is primarily for QCWA members, but provides information for those who want to know about QCWA's structure. This year, QCWA members vote to decide who will fill the necessary organizational positions within their association. Up for grabs biannually are all the elected executive offices and directorships. The elected executives consist of president, vice president, secretary, and treasurer. Also chosen are 8 non-geographically based directors. Therefore, each member will choose from the slate of candidates presented, up to 12 persons, to take the lead in looking after QCWA's interests. A question that might be asked at this juncture is, which position is the most important for the success of our association? By reviewing the major assignments, we will identify the MIP. We'll use the masculine pronoun for simplicity's sake. Please understand that it also includes ladies. Material from QCWA's constitution and bylaws is used. The first MIP we might think of as the general manager. This position is not an elected one, nor does he have a board vote. He is more of an employee or a contractor looking after all the day-to-day operational and administrative functions of the Quarter Century Wireless Association, a full-time paid position for running the headquarters office. The necessary tasks include processing membership applications, verifying new applicant eligibility, filling member supply requests, producing milestone recognition certificates, collecting and banking revenues received from new and renewal memberships, and supply orders, keeping all records, performing duties associated with the QCWH Journal and its distribution, ballot, mailing, etc. Would this be the most important person we're looking for? Our Quarter Century Wireless Association president is the most visible of all positions. He is not just a figurehead, but has a myriad of functions to perform. He presides at all membership meetings as well as board meetings, possessing a vote on the board, as do all executive members. He oversees the carrying out of all mandates and directives established by the board of directors, and he is also the one who appoints the various committees needed for the smooth running of the QCWA, as per the board's authorization. He calls special meetings as required, and he sits on some of the standing committees as an advisor. Is he, perhaps, QCWA's most important position? Then there is the vice president. The VP has various duties associated with positions on committees as assigned. He also has to be ready and able to seemingly take over the president's job if the person is no longer able to continue that capacity, temporarily or permanently. How about him? Could he be MIP? Every organization needs someone to record all proceedings of the board, for example, the minutes of board meetings. If it's not written down, it didn't happen. That is the job of the secretary. He is also responsible for distributing those minutes to all board members as well as to the membership by way of a summary posted in the QCWA Journal. He also maintains and updates the director's guide, and he maintains the corporate status of the association by filing all necessary reports and documents with the proper authority. Very important functions, these. But is he our MIP? An association needs money to function. The QCWA is no different. The treasurer is the position in charge of the responsible handling of QCWA's financial assets. Like all executive positions, he falls under the collective authority of the board of directors. He is the one who prepares the proposed operating budget for submission to the finance committee and to the board itself prior to the annual board meeting. In short, he tries to ensure the financial good health of QCWA. Notwithstanding the importance of each of the above, the directors as a group determine how things are run in QCWA, policies of organization. The executives carry out the policies established by the directors. It is the current policy of QCWA that all standing committees be chaired by the director and that all directors must participate in the committee governance of the QCWA. Theirs is not an idle position, and since policies are conceived and overseen at the committee level, subject to board approval, they have a very important role to play. Could the standing of most important position belong to them? The answer, of course, is no. None of the above can be considered the MIP of QCWA. The MIP's identification lies in the direction of all the work and volunteer service provided by the above positions and by all volunteers within our organization. All these tasks are done for you, the Quarter Century Wireless Association member. In fact, all of those people who have devoted their time and energy to the furtherance of our association would readily admit that they do it for you, the members. It is also the individual members who select the individuals that they want to be in the various positions of responsibility and service. And finally, it is the QCWA membership who finances our organization through their dues. You, as a QCWA member, hold the most important position in QCWA. The executives and board are only part of the smooth operation of the Quarter Century Wireless Association. Our association runs on volunteers. Do you have a skill, perhaps from your vocation, which would benefit QCWA? Consider volunteering some of your time and talents toward the health and prosperity of QCWA. One can start at the chapter level, helping create a healthy local group presence. The prosperity of QCWA depends upon the health and vitality of its individual chapters. They are the building blocks of our association. From there, one might offer assistance to the national organization, perhaps helping one of the several standing committees. The bottom line is this is a member-driven organization dedicated to providing a venue for enjoying one's senior, inexperienced years as a radio amateur. The more each of us feels part of the process by having a share in it, the more we will all see QCWA as our home. Not a member yet? If you were first licensed 25 or more years ago, why not join the QCWA and fill the most important position we have, a member of this great group of the proud, the elite, and the many? Let's take a few moments now to look at Contest Corner. The American Radio Relay League International DX competition is March the 6th. It's from the bands of 160 through 10 meters, single sideband, which is voice or phone. If you're looking to catch Idaho on the amateur bands, their QSO party is actually on the 1st of March through the 2nd. So look around in the different categories for the Idaho QSO party. Then we have the state of Wisconsin QSO party. That's the 14th and 15th of March. It's all bands and modes, CW and single sideband. And on the 20th of March, the 1010 International Mobile Contest, it's going to be 10 meters only, single sideband and CW. Then getting down to the southern part of our country, it's going to be a little warmer down in Virginia for their QSO party on the 20th of March. Well, we like to think that we'll be anyway. Seems as though the weather down in the mid-Atlantic and southern mid-Atlantic is much worse than it has been up in New England. So you just have to listen around the bands and hear the interesting commentary about people enjoying their hobby of amateur radio. You know, folks, as I look through the rest of the magazine, there's a column here. It talks about visiting your local radio club. You know, amateur radio organizations are everywhere. Of course, for many people, if they've never been interested in ham radio or know how to find them, it's very simple. More often than not, you could look in the telephone book and you'll see a radio club listed there. Or talk to friends who know ham radio operators and they'll lead you to the place that's going to show you how to get into a marvelously new and exciting hobby for you. We have one listed here in California, the Fresno California Amateur Radio Club that meets on the second Friday of every month in California. Also the El Dorado County Amateur Radio Club on the fourth Thursday monthly. It's at the Federated Church in Thompson Way, Placerville, California. In Hawaii, well, we'd like to be there vacationing right now in late February, but there is a ham radio club there too, the Honolulu ARC. They meet at 0900 for breakfast in January, March, May, July, and September, and November at the Sizzler restaurant at Pearl Ridge. State of Illinois, the North Shore Radio Club. That's one of Chicago's largest and most active radio clubs. There are quite a few in the Chicago area because it's a large metropolitan area, so check those out. And, of course, the Williamsburg Area Amateur Radio Club in Williamsburg, Virginia. I think I'll finish up today with a little bit of propagation information. This is an article by Carl Lutschenschwab, K9LA. He titles it 15-meter long path to Japan during the 2009 CQ Worldwide CW Contest. Although we're at a solar minimum, the higher bands can sometimes surprise us with some interesting openings. For example, during last November's CQ Worldwide CW, Morse code, contest, which was November 28 and 29, the W3LPL multi-team reported a 15-meter long path opening on Saturday night between midnight and 1 a.m. into Japan, the Hawaiian Islands, and Southeastern Asia. Let's take an in-depth look at this opening to see just what happened. If we run the VOACAP from W3LPL to Japan for a 15 meters long path at a smoothed sunspot number of 15, which appears to be where November 2009 will end up with the current cycle 24 activity, we end up with the MUF, that's the maximum usable frequency predictions in Table 1 shown here on page 30. I won't go into that, folks. The median MUF in the second column maximizes at 0600 UTC. That's the universal time, and that's a good indicator that something could happen on this path. Since 14.8 megahertz is the median MUF, that's implying the MUF is at least 14.8 megahertz on half the days of the month, we need to estimate how high the MUF could be on just one day. We can do this by using the appropriate data in the tables of MUF variability in our ionospheric references. This is what the third column shown there estimates. The MUF on the best day of the month, which is necessarily an extremely low probability. Thus, around 0600 UTC, the MUF on just one day of the month along the long path from W3LPL to JA is predicted to be as high as 22.0 megahertz, which means that there should be a 15-meter opening. Due to the day-to-day variation of the ionosphere not being well correlated to a daily solar index, we can't predict which day of the month is the best one. Thus, it's a hit-and-miss prospect if the best day falls on the contest weekend. It apparently did this year for CQ Worldwide CW. To understand why this short duration and extremely low probability opening exists, we need to determine which end of the path is the critical end. Knowing that VOACAP uses the concept of a control point to predict the F2 range MUF for long-distance paths, with the lowest MUF of the two control points being the path MUF, we can then look at the appropriate end of the path on our monthly median F2 region maps to see what happened. As a refresher, the control point method relies on the fact that long-distance ionospheric propagation appears to be supported if propagation at the two control points is supported. For F2 propagation, these control points are 2,000 kilometers from each end of the path. From the data in Method 1 of VOACAP, we determined that the control point on the W3LPL end at 23.5 north latitude and 66.6 west longitude, which is in the Eastern Caribbean, has the lowest MUF, which makes it the critical control point. The median MUF data on Table 1 is for this control point. Let's look at this area on an F2 map at 0600 UTC in November at a smooth sunspot number of 15. Figure 1 in the publication shows this map. In Figure 1, the control point on the W3LPL end of the path is the blue star within the big red circle. With a bit of mental manipulation, we can see what's happening. There's a northeastern extension of higher MUFs that moves over the control point on the W3LPL end of the long path to Japan at 0600 UTC. It's well to the east of this control point at times significantly before 0600 UTC and well to the west of this control point at later times. What about the fact that W3LPL took advantage of this path earlier than 0600 UTC? That's not hard to explain, as the map of Figure 1 is a monthly median map In other words, it's essentially an average over the month, and the day-to-day variability of the ionosphere could easily have put this northeastward extension of higher MUFs over the W3LPL control point somewhere earlier than 0600 UTC. The interesting fact to note in this northeastern extension of higher MUFs is in our monthly median maps, and thus it predicts this short duration and extremely low probability opening. I think the most important takeaway from this month's column is the understanding that there are a lot of similar short duration and extremely low probability openings waiting for us. But to take advantage of it, we need to be in the right place at the right time. Folks, that article on propagation of amateur radio waves around the world at given times and given places and points of entry and exit and so forth, as he was very eloquently explaining it, is authored by Carl Lutschel-Schwab, called K9LA. Carl has been writing for many years on somewhat more technical material like this, but for any really active ham radio operator and any of those that are interested in becoming more active in different aspects of amateur radio, this kind of stuff gets to be sort of important. But like anything else, amateur radio has to be licensed by the Federal Communications Commission. People have to get their manuals, be taught how to use their radios and other equipment, and along the way they gain this knowledge of a marvelous hobby that so many thousands of people throughout the world enjoy every single day, every minute of every day, actually, because with radio waves, you can go just about anywhere, like this 15-meter-long Path to Japan thing we just finished off. Well, this is Bob Zeta. My amateur radio call sign is N1BLF, November 1, Bravo Lima Foxtrot. My QTH, or geographic location, is Dartmouth, Massachusetts. We are approximately 50 miles south of Boston, right on Buzzards Bay, on the way to Cape Cod and Martha's Vineyard and Nantucket. It's not too much fun over there right now. It's raining hard and it's cold outside and there's still a trace of snow. But it can't be too much longer before we'll be looking at some flowers and some good radio activities as well. This recording is a production of the Courage Andy Ham System, 3915 Golden Valley Road, Golden Valley, Minnesota, 55422. It is for the use of eligible Andy Ham members only. Any other use may violate copyright laws. Andy Hams may be reached at area 763-520-0512 or at email address, lowercase, one word, Handy Ham, H-A-N-D-I-H-A-M. At Courage, courage.org, andyhammettcourage.org. Marvelous website, kept up to date every single day, all kinds of marvelous information and links to other activities in science and, of course, in amateur radio. The website is www.handyham.org. We've been reading together the online edition of World Radio Magazine for March 2010. The managing editor, Richard S. Mawson, called W2VU. World Radio is a publication of CQ Communications Incorporated, 25 Newbridge Road, Hicksville, New York, 11801. Thanks a lot for listening along again with me this month. 73, Bob Zeta, N1BLF.